depth of Rachel's intent letter to realize that much of Susan's ranting had been little more than posturing. The lawsuit was definitely not irrelevant to the murder. If a $2 million suit wasn't enough to make friends mortal enemies, Gabby didn't know what was. Her new theory was that Nadal had approached Rachel on the jetty to negotiate a settlement favorable to his company. Rachel had refused, and he'd lost it. Although Gabby had to admit, the self-possessed man in Interrogation 1 didn't seem like the kind of guy to lose it. A copy of Rachel's letter lay in her lap, printed from a PDF in Nadal's email. Gabby read the argument set forth in the document a second time, seeking a better reason for Nadal to want Rachel dead. Gabby couldn't imagine he would have killed Rachel in blind hope of making the case go away. He was too smart for that. Nadal had to have been so angry that he'd lost the ability to see things rationally, she decided. But why become so enraged that night? He'd known about the lawsuit for days. What had changed? Gabby rubbed her eyes and opened her mouth in another face-swallowing yawn. She'd reached the portion of her 16-hour workday when even a third cup of coffee couldn't keep her alert and focused. She transferred the letter from her lap to the desktop, stood up and jogged in place, trying to jolt her brain with a little exercise. Think, Gabriella, think. She stared at the stoic figure in the one-way window as she shifted her weight from the ball of one foot to the other. An hour earlier, she'd accused Nadal's wife of murdering Rachel over a betrayal. The same motive, she supposed, could apply to Nadal. He'd likely thought Rachel had wronged him, using their friendship to target his life's work. Perhaps Rachel had admitted as much during the vacation, thus justifying his growing fury. Or she'd been pestering him about the suit, stoking his rage. Gabby tried to imagine Nadal livid, but the image didn't materialize. A knock pulled her attention from the screen. Gabby stopped her Richard Simmons impression before the door opened. She stood in the center of the cramped space, no doubt looking guilty and embarrassed for having nearly been caught running in place. DeMarco hovered inside the door jamb. He held a manila folder between both of his hands, an altar boy with a prayer book. Sorry for interrupting. The coroner's report came back. They rushed it, given the nature of the crime. Gabby stretched her arms over her head. She felt less tired, though her second wind had more to do with her hope for what lay inside the envelope than her brief exercise session. Tell me we have some hard evidence. DeMarco passed her the folder. She was killed between 12:30 and 1 a.m. If there was any DNA from her killer, the water destroyed it. But there were fingerprints on the neck belonging to Nadal Amati. Gabby opened the file and scanned the first page of the near dozen inside. I don't know that the fingerprints mean much. He said he checked her pulse. DeMarco scratched his chin. His usually shorn jaw showed a significant shadow. Well, that might be a reason for the prints. Or maybe he only did that to cover up strangling her. There were a couple sets of his index and middle fingers on her neck, and a partial palm print near the center of her throat. Gabby looked back through the window. Nadal stared at the mirror, as though trying to see through to the detectives he knew were in the neighboring room. His brown eyes seemed to be appealing to her. Don't do it. Don't. Gabby didn't feel great about her next move, but she had to make it. Nadal's prints were on the body. He'd been embroiled in a $2 million lawsuit with the deceased. He was refusing to answer questions, and, given that his wife had been passed out after a night of heavy drinking, he lacked an alibi witness for the time frame of Rachel's murder. She couldn't let the man hightail it back to Westchester. With his money, it might be the last time she saw him. Let's do this, then. Detective DeMarco fished a pair of metal cuffs from a pouch on the utility belt securing his dress slacks. Gabby followed him into the hallway and then pulled back the door to Interrogation 1. DeMarco went in first, dangling the bracelets. Nidal Ahmadi, she said, you are under arrest for the murder of Rachel Klein. Chapter 25, The Day After. Cicadas were screaming. Their stuttering mechanical screech struck Susan as she exited the police station, barreling over her like a broken lawnmower. She hadn't noticed the insects at the beach, though she supposed that wasn't surprising. She'd been so concentrated on setting up her family in their new town this past year, and distracted by her own identity crisis, not to mention her nightly glasses of wine, that she hadn't critically examined her surroundings, or whom she'd been surrounding herself with. But now, her focus had returned. A dozen years as a criminal defense attorney had equipped Susan with a psychic X-ray, enabling her to see her opponent's internal strategies. That detective was going to arrest her husband. Rachel's submersion had surely corrupted most, if not all, of the physical evidence, leaving the police with little choice but to build a case based on the trio of means, motive, and opportunity. Nidal easily possessed the strength to strangle or drown Rachel, and $2 million, while not a devastating amount to Nidal's company, was a sufficiently damaging sum to appear a compelling motive. Her hungover, thoughtless admission that she'd slept on the couch had provided the cops with the final piece of their circumstantial case, depriving her husband of an alibi. Susan cursed herself as she hurried down the street, rushing to escape the locusts' deafening crescendo from the tree-lined properties beside the station. She pulled her phone from her purse and began scrolling through her contacts. She needed to get her former boss on Nidal's team. But first, she needed to call Greg Travers, Doc Tago's general counsel and chief business officer, not to mention Nidal's dear friend, back in Seattle. He'd be the one answering calls about the arrest of the firm's CEO on murder charges related to a lawsuit against the company. She couldn't have Greg surprised and revealing anything to police or the press that would unintentionally exacerbate Nadal's already bad situation. The lack of a news van parked on the street was a fortunate surprise. Susan attributed it to the police's desire to keep the murder quiet until they were ready to announce an arrest. The East Hampton department was small enough that they could control the flow of information. It also helped that Rachel had been killed on a private beach and discovered before the people with access had set up their sun umbrellas. The cicadas' screech faded as Susan reached the town's main street, identifiable by the two lanes of traffic in each direction and the wide sidewalks, lined with restaurants. She crossed in the middle of the street, heading toward a white public bench in front of a juice bar. Greg's line was ringing before she sat down. Hello? Susan? Gregory said her name like his caller ID had made a mistake. She'd never phoned him before. Yes, I'm calling about Nidal. He's been arrested on murder charges, or is about to be. Had Susan been thinking like Nadal's wife, saying the statement aloud would have sent her into hysterics. But her shift into defense attorney mode had given her a preternatural calm. Our neighbor, Rachel Klein, was found dead on the beach, either strangled or drowned, Susan continued. We were vacationing with her, and as I'm sure you are aware, she was representing the family suing the company for negligence. Susan paused, giving her points time to find their mark, the way she would have if Greg had been a jury member. When she heard Greg's breathing quicken on the other end of the line, she resumed her opening statement. To my knowledge, there isn't any hard evidence connecting Nidal to the crime. The cops just saw the $2 million suit and thought motive. Susan stopped a second time, hoping Greg would fill the silence with facts helpful to Nadal's defense. The suit is in the process of being settled, maybe. Or Nidal was under strict instructions not to talk to Rachel about the case, making it unlikely that he would have gotten into any kind of altercation with her about it. Susan would even have taken an assurance that Nadal had looked forward to arguing the case in court, even though any eagerness to fight the grieving family of a dead child would have made him look like a combative jerk. Her husband would need to come off as likable to combat any negative biases that a jury of his peers might harbor against people of his Middle Eastern background, wealth, or occupation. Still, better a jerk than a murderer. Shit, 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 shit. Greg whispered the swear over and over, a train chugging toward a cliff. Shit. Okay. Shit. Susan had expected Greg's shock, but the string of epithets rang with a hopelessness she hadn't anticipated. She wiped the sweat from her brow, brought on by the bench's position in the sun rather than fear. She had too much to accomplish in the next few hours to allow herself to feel afraid. He obviously didn't do it, Greg. I'm not certain that a prosecutor will even take the case with the circumstantial nonsense they have. But I need you to be ready for the press with something better than a no comment. A child shouted in the background on Greg's end. Not now. Daddy's on the phone. Susan heard the twitter of birds and then the slam of the door. She forced a swallow. Greg had been enjoying the day with his kids, she told herself. He needed a minute to switch into emergency mode. Okay, we'll start working on a statement. Rachel Klein was a dear friend of Nadal Ahmadi and his family. They are saddened by her loss and flabbergasted. No, not that. Deeply hurt and shocked that the police would arrest Nadal without any evidence. The lawsuit was a business matter that was already being handled through the proper channels. The ease with which the statement rolled off Greg's tongue relieved Susan. This was the ally she needed. Yes, stress those last 2 points. What about his alibi? Susan gripped the phone tighter, tempted to smack the side of her head with it. He'd gone to bed upstairs. I drank too much and passed out downstairs. I'll say that I would have heard him if he'd left the house, but they'll argue that I was too inebriated to wake up. I apparently didn't hear another friend come in. Greg cursed again. The press isn't going to like that. They'll think that if his own wife can't back him, then... I know. Susan nearly groaned, responding like herself rather than her professional alter ego. She curled her free hand into a fist, fighting the return to the insecure, anxious woman she'd been earlier. I'll send you some pictures of him smiling. The business shot on the webpage is too stoic.
Good idea.
Greg coughed.
It'd be even better, though, to send the media hunting in another direction. Are there any other possible suspects? The victim's husband, maybe? Or that ER doc? He was at the house with you guys, right?
Susan took a breath. This was what defense attorneys did in emergencies. They created reasonable doubt, even if it meant casting the blame on someone who likely didn't deserve it. Rachel's husband had argued with her right before her murder, but I wouldn't focus on him. The cops wouldn't have let him go unless he had a pretty airtight alibi. And unfortunately, I don't see how Lewis was involved at all. My guess is that someone saw Rachel.
Not involved?
Greg said, incredulous.
Rachel was suing Lewis's malpractice insurer for $1 million. He's the doctor in the case, the one accused of prescribing without getting a complete medical history.
The new information blasted through Susan's brain, shattering the picture of the prior night that she'd formed in her head. Lewis hadn't asked about Nadal's company out of personal curiosity. He'd wanted to get a sense of how Nadal intended to respond to the lawsuit. He'd demanded the drink with Nadal to pressure him into settling the case quickly, perhaps hoping that $2 million would sufficiently entice Rachel's clients to accept his insurer's initial offer. Greg was still talking, arranging the pieces of the puzzle, as Susan was putting them together herself.
My guess is that Lewis had more to lose from the case than us. insurers drop physicians for stupid mistakes like that, or they hike the premiums to something unsustainable. And good luck continuing to work without coverage.
Susan remembered Lewis's hard words about Rachel the prior night. He'd characterized her as greedy and implied that she brought frivolous suits to make money. He'd been angry, more than angry. Her case could have cost him his career, the very thing that defined him. Susan hadn't realized, but Lewis must have been murderous.
"Does he have an alibi?" Greg asked.
"My guess is only his wife, but you know that prosecutors don't give a spouse's word much weight. I doubt that the police even know about Lewis's involvement. I didn't even know." Susan recalled how Nadal had consistently referred to the doctor in the case by his profession or pronoun. She hadn't given it much thought, figuring that he wasn't mentioning the name since she didn't know the man or had been bound by a confidentiality agreement. But he'd been protecting Lewis. The cicada's softer chirp swelled behind her. Nadal had been trying to keep the lawsuit hush-hush so as not to ruin the vacation. Perhaps Lewis had done the same as well, withholding the news from Jenny to avoid causing a rift between her and Rachel. Or maybe Lewis had simply been too embarrassed to tell his wife. Lewis prided himself on being a superb doctor. He wouldn't have wanted to reveal to anyone that his prescription error had resulted in a child's death. But regardless of Lewis's reasons for keeping the suit quiet, Nadal needed to tell everyone about his involvement. Now.
"I've got to go, Greg," she said. "I've made a mistake."
Susan hung up before he could respond and sprinted toward the police station. She shouldn't have instructed Nadal to remain silent. They both had to tell the cops everything they knew about Lewis Murray. Chapter 26, The Day After. Jenny knew what she had to do. The plan had come to her the prior night as she'd run from the house, emerging fully developed like some parasite she'd unwittingly nurtured for years. Its existence had horrified and disgusted her at first. Still, Jenny had known that she couldn't kill it. She needed it. She ran it over in her mind again as her body slid on the plastic bench in the back of the police car, threatening to send her careening into Lewis. He was sitting too close to her, continuing to play the loving, protective spouse as he had the entire time in the police station. The over-the-top affection was a transparent plea for her silence, fueled by Lewis's fear that she might suddenly unwrap the scarf from her neck and explain the welts all over it. He'd been asleep by the time she'd finally sneaked into the bedroom the prior night, and they'd both woken to the thuds of police boots downstairs. Having not had a chance to apologize and contextualize his actions, Lewis didn't know whether she'd forgiven him or if he was one wrong word away from her pressing charges. Lewis's concern about the cops was unwarranted, though. Jenny's plan didn't involve the police arresting her husband and handing her a restraining order, which Lewis would respect about as much as her personal space. There was only one way to keep Lewis from murdering her someday, like Rachel had been. She had to kill him herself. Jenny gripped the handle of the police door as the car swung a right onto the block of beach houses, refusing to let gravity pull her back into her husband's embrace. She might latch onto a hug as evidence that Lewis loved her enough to change, when the truth was that though he loved her, he wasn't strong enough to change. The cruiser stopped in front of the house. She robotically thanked Officer Phillips through the glass divider. The young cop released the locks on the back doors.
"You're lucky the place wasn't designated a secondary crime scene."
Phillips leaned his head out the open driver's side window as Jenny passed.
"You wouldn't have been able to collect your suitcases. Fortunately for you both, the woman that owns the place has some pull. I guess the department didn't want to risk paying her the $50,000 she'd lose canceling a month's worth of renters."
Lewis rounded the car and reached for her hand. Jenny quickly raised it instead, waving goodbye to the patrolman before her husband could grab her fingers. She could feel Lewis waiting at her side, his energy tugging at her like a current. She broke free of it, jogging past him to the glass front door, framed by the already parted barn doors. Inputting the unlock code took a moment, enabling Lewis to slide an arm beneath her dangling purse and grab her waist. He pressed his lips to her temple, inches above the bruise still healing from the prior week.
"I love you," he said.
Jenny controlled her shudder, murmuring something that he could interpret as her returning the sentiment. Behind them, shells rattled beneath the cruiser's chassis, like change in a dryer. Jenny opened the door, looking over her shoulder to watch the marked car turn onto the main road before entering the house. The place felt searched, even though it hadn't been ransacked. Sand, likely jostled from police boots, littered the cement floor in the great room. One of the couch cushions had been tilted forward. The recycling bin had been pulled from its former spot and the plastic bag with the empty wine bottles removed. The scotch, however, still occupied its last known location on the kitchen counter. Jenny rested free of Lewis's groping presence for the second time and headed toward the near-empty bottle.
"I need a drink," she pointed to the whiskey.
"Grab you one for the road, too?" Lewis hovered by the couch, pulling at his bottom lip as he often did when he wanted to discuss something uncomfortable. Jenny warned him off without words, looking him in the eye and unwrapping the red scarf coiled around her slender neck. She balled the fabric in her fist and tilted her head back, displaying the potato-shaped swellings in purple, yellow, and red.
"My throat is killing me. All those questions."
She groaned and picked up the bottle. "I need to steady my nerves. Would you get the bags?" Jenny knew that Lewis would never refuse a man's job, like carrying heavy luggage. He dutifully turned around to the steps and headed to the second floor. She watched him climb. He held the banister as he ascended, releasing it for only a moment at the top step. A buzzing called his attention to his back pocket. He answered after he was securely on the landing.
"Hello?"
"Hi, Allie." Jenny tried to ignore the stabbing pain in her chest at hearing her daughter's name. Allie was a daddy's girl. She'd missed him enough after 24 hours to check in. She hadn't called Jenny at all. Jenny opened the dishwasher drawer and withdrew two of the tumblers from the prior night. As she placed their wide, hexagonal bottoms on the counter, she tried to think only of their heft and not what she planned to do with them, of how losing Lewis would rip through her daughter's heart. Jenny grabbed the whiskey and filled one glass. She cursed under her breath, pretending to have spilled some in case Lewis watched, and then peeled three sheets of paper towels from a roll beside the sink. The bedroom door shut as Lewis went to get the bags. Jenny started to work faster, smoothing the paper towels into a pad atop the counter, telling herself all the while that Allie would recover from what she was about to do. A torn muscle, as excruciating as it was, could be repaired. Jenny knew how. And the heart was just a muscle. She'd devote herself to replacing the love and affection Allie missed from her dad, again becoming her daughter's friend and confidant. And Allie, whether she knew it or not, would grow up healthier and happier without an abusive man in the house. Jenny dropped the purse hanging off her shoulder onto the counter. She sifted through it for her prescription bottles and then dug both hands inside to open the sleep aids, afraid that if she put the bottle on the counter, Lewis might pop out of the room unexpectedly and see it. As fast as she could, she plucked five from the container, placed them on the paper towels, and then folded the sheets over the white oblong pills, creating a Zolpidem sandwich. A 10-milligram Ambien was enough to put a grown man to sleep for hours. 50 milligrams wouldn't kill Lewis, but it would make sure he was conked out when she drove him to a deserted beach later,
filled his pockets with stones, and dumped him in the water. She'd report him missing after a few hours, saying he'd taken the car after claiming to not be able to live with himself for what he'd done to Rachel. Unlike her, the police didn't know that Lewis could live with himself no matter what. Jenny picked up an empty tumbler and brought the heavy base down hard against the bump in the paper towels. She slammed it down a second time, twisting it afterward to really crush the pills into a powder. Using the paper towel like a funnel, she poured the flex into the glass and then tossed the sheets into the sink's garbage disposal drain. She poured water on the paper and then flicked the switch affixed to the backsplash, grinding up the evidence that wouldn't be dissolved by liquor. Finally, she poured 3 inches of whiskey over the powdered pills. The liquid's alcohol content was sufficiently high that she didn't even need a spoon to dissolve the pieces. Swirling the glass for a few seconds did the trick. The resulting amber mixture reminded her of Lewis's hair in the sunlight. Jenny ignored the emotional cramp that accompanied the observation. Pain didn't matter. She needed to get to the end of this. Jenny downed her unadulterated shot for courage and then gingerly climbed the stairs, holding Lewis's tumbler tight to her chest. The drugs would take about 10 minutes to hit his system. After that, he'd become sluggish and sloppy. His speech would slur. His eyes would glaze. He'd say things that only made sense to his subconscious. Lewis? Jenny called to him through the master bedroom door as she ascended to the second floor. Honey, are you ready? She knocked. Are you still talking to Allie? The door flung back. Lewis barreled from the room like a beast under attack, nostrils flared, eyes wild with fury. He charged at Jenny, driving her back toward the floating staircase. She struggled to find the root of his anger. Had he told Allie about Rachel and she'd become upset? Had he accused Ben and Allie had refused to believe it? Why was he looking at her like that? Jenny extended the glass in her hand. I poured you that whiskey. Lewis grabbed the drink and threw it back like a shot of tequila. He smacked his lips together and then brought the crystal up to his face. For a moment, he seemed to admire its craftsmanship, checking out the angles of the thick walls, weighing its solid base. You fucked him, didn't you? The question registered just before Lewis smashed the glass into the side of her head. She saw the whole thing, you whore. The words wafted over to Jenny, cushioned in white noise. A fizzing rushed through her ear canal. She saw shoes. Leather moccasins dyed a deep indigo that she'd bought Lewis specifically for the vacation. He loomed over her. He was saying something, yelling something. Chloe and Allie were in the fucking backyard. They saw everything. You and him, right there in the window. The right shoe lifted and pulled back. Instinctively, Jenny wrapped her arms over her bleeding head and brought her knees to cover her vital organs. She screamed, a reflex to the pain that she knew was imminent. The foot swung down, slamming into her shins with a fury. Right there in the fucking window! Jenny heard the snap of her splintering fibula. Her body reacted to the break as though it had plunged underwater. Instinct took over, trapping the air in her lungs. Blood rushed to her head with all the pain of a brain freeze. Chloe wanted to wait to tell her mom until they'd gone to camp, apparently, so she wouldn't be around them fighting. Allie didn't even want me to know it all. She had to beg Chloe not to tell Rachel it was you. A second kick landed in the center of her solar plexus. Pain burned the air in Jenny's lungs. She gasped and coughed as she curled into a tighter ball. But when Chloe told her that Rachel was dead, Allie was afraid you were running off with her best friend's dad. Needles stabbed into Jenny's bare skin. As she brought her arms to cover her face, her skin seemed to shimmer with glitter. No, not glitter, glass.
The tumbler had shattered. Lewis had drunk it before it had broken, hadn't he? She couldn't think straight, with the throbbing in her ribcage and the pounding in her head. Either way, the pills would take time, and she wouldn't survive 10 minutes of this. She pressed her left hand into the shrapnel-covered ground and twisted her knees under her, trying to stand on her good leg. Before she could rise, Lewis grabbed her hair, yanking her back onto her haunches. He crouched in front of her, features twisted into a gargoyle's expression.
"You must think you're really special, huh? You can have any man you want, is that it? Even the married playboy next door."
A stinging slap on her mouth sharpened her understanding. Chloe and Allie had known about the affair. The call had been Allie telling Lewis, and Lewis was going to kill her. Jenny didn't waste her energy on excuses. Nothing she said would matter. Her only hope was to wrestle free of her husband's grasp and somehow escape down the stairs before he could shove her, head first, onto the concrete floor below. Though she thrashed in his grasp, he managed to hold on, despite the drugs coursing through his system.
"How many times did you go over there for a lay, Jen?"
Lewis brought his face closer to hers. Jenny wrenched herself back in one final attempt to break free. Lewis held on and screamed in her face,
"How many fucking times?"
He'd beaten her so many times, she needed it to end.
"Well?"
Hair ripped from her scalp as Lewis yanked her upright. Her broken leg buckled, bringing her back down to her knees despite Lewis's grip on her hair.
"You don't deny it?"
He dragged her toward the stairs. Tears spilled down her cheeks. She remembered her husband as he'd been once, the young doctor who, after nights of interrupted sleep and sewing people back together, had come home to stroke her pregnant belly and assuage her nerves. The father who had built dollhouses, sat for tea parties, and taught Allie to ride a pink bike with a Hello Kitty bell. The husband who had carried her over the threshold of their home, caressed her, taking care of her. She'd loved that Lewis, but he'd died long ago, and now he wanted to take her with him. Chapter 27, The Day After. Susan talked with her hands when excited. Gabby sat in her office chair, trying to maintain a concrete expression as she watched Susan's emphatic air chops. A petty part of her hoped to end the conversation in the same abrupt way of their earlier interview, this time with Gabby thanking Susan for outlining the opposition's ridiculous case. A larger part of her wanted to usher the woman from her room, drive with the sirens blaring to the bed she'd abandoned 18 hours earlier, and collapse atop the mattress. Trumping all those selfish desires, however, was an ache to arrest the right person. Though Gabby's head told her that the businessman in lockup was the most likely culprit, her soul lacked faith that she'd put away the right man. Slapping cuffs on Nadal should have felt righteous. Instead, she'd felt wrong, not to mention worried that the prosecutor's office would agree. She didn't know whether arresting Lewis would feel any different. At the house, the redhead had been true to stereotype, hot-tempered and quick to hurl accusations. It was possible he'd killed Rachel in a rage about the lawsuit, had his wife cover for him, and then fingered Ben to deflect blame. But since Gabby hadn't personally interviewed him, her sixth sense was silent on the matter. "Lewis's whole ego is wrapped up in being this great doctor," Susan continued. "The prospect of losing his license would have driven him crazy. Believe me, he killed Rachel. You can't charge Nadal." Gabby rotated her chair a couple of centimeters to either side, using activity to fight off the sleep she desperately needed. "Reasonable doubt is for trials, Mrs. Amati. We have a case against your husband."
"No, you don't."
Gabby stood, signaling the end to Susan's audience.
I'll talk to Lewis first before filing my report on Nadal's arrest. That's the best I can offer. Susan's arm flung toward Gabby's bookcase. A clock sat on the indicated shelf.
You better hurry. One of your officers already drove him and Jenny to their car.
What?
Gabby rounded the desk. She'd told Detective DeMarco not to let anyone leave. He must have thought Nadal's arrest had changed things.
I'm on it.
Gabby opened the door, letting Susan out first. I'll let you know.
With the siren wailing, Gabby reached the house in 5 minutes. Two vehicles sat outside the rental. Gabby exited her cruiser and approached the entrance.
The late afternoon sun reflected in the house's windows, preventing her from seeing inside. She pressed the bell on the electronic lock. Through the door, she heard the buzzer and what sounded like a man shouting.
Pressing her face to its tinted glass panels revealed nothing save for a darkened view of the empty foyer and tunnel-like hallway.
She heard the sound again. A man was definitely yelling. She hustled around the side of the house and into the backyard, keeping her right arm bent by her holster, hand angled in the ready position. The glare that had blinded her in the front now illuminated the view through the glass wall. Gabby saw the white couch, its pillows askew, and a whiskey bottle atop the kitchen counter. The male roar was louder, though its source remained hidden. A female scream drew Gabby's attention to the second floor. Lewis stood on the mezzanine level, his right leg bent behind him as though he were about to kick a soccer ball. By his feet, Jenny lay curled in an armadillo defense, bony arms covering her face, hands spread over the top of her head, knees tucked to her chest.
Stop! Police!
Gabby's command went unheeded. Lewis's foot slammed into Jenny's leg, sending her rounded form several inches closer to the open stairwell. Gabby watched through the windows as though she'd stumbled upon a drive-in theater showing a horror flick. Lewis crouched beside his wife and wrapped his fist in her hair. He began yanking her upright, pushing her toward the open stairs. He's going to toss her over. A surge of adrenaline overcame Gabby's paralyzing shock. She ran to the door and its electronic lock. 4 numbers, she remembered. A date in history. One of them had been a 9, she thought. Her overwhelmed and exhausted brain would never deliver the correct digits. Lewis's curses pierced the windows. He was dragging Jenny by her hair toward the staircase, screaming epithets and questions.
How many times, Jen? How many fucking times?
Gabby grabbed her gun, aimed the muzzle at the glass, and pulled the trigger. The explosion was followed by a sharp crack. A perfect circle punctured the tempered glass. An alarm screamed to life, alternating tones like an ambulance siren between blaring robotic warnings.
Attention! Glass break detected. The police have been called. Attention!
Gabby wrapped the hem of her jacket around the Glock's hot barrel, holding the pistol like a tomahawk. She rammed the grip against the bullet hole. This time, glass sprayed. She switched her weapon into her left hand and stuck her right through the opening she'd created. Shards scratched white lines into her brown knuckles and tore at her sleeve as she stretched down to the handle. The door lock released. Inside the house, the alarm was as loud as if Gabby had been outside her cruiser with the siren blaring. She rushed into the great room, added her right hand to the left already gripping the Glock. Her index finger found the trigger.
Police! Step away!
Gabby screamed, loud and shrill as the alarm.
Step away or I'll shoot!
Lewis released his wife's hair, but remained standing over her, positioned to send Jenny hurtling down the staircase with a hard kick to her side.
Step away!
Gabby brought the gun up higher and gazed down the barrel, signaling to Lewis that he was in her sights.
She did it!
He pointed to the mangled person at his feet.
She killed Rachel!
Jenny appeared incapable of hurting anyone. Her arms wrapped around her torso, as though holding her ribs together. Blood matted her dark hair and dribbled down the right side of her face. Deep purple welts encircled her bare neck.
I was trying to protect her,
Lewis shouted, ignoring the contrary evidence in front of him.
I lied and said she was with me last night, but she was out there.
The finger accusing Jenny flung toward the wall of windows.
I saw her fighting Rachel from the balcony. She tossed her into the water.
Jenny pressed a hand to the floor, pushing herself up on her side. She tried to say something, but all that emerged were a series of sputtering coughs. Gabby didn't need the woman to defend herself. From Gabby's vantage point, it was clear who was the killer. Lewis grasped the railing atop the mezzanine's glass wall.
I thought she'd found out about the suit and confronted Rachel. I thought I had to cover for her. I thought she'd done it for me, for us.
Lewis's shoulders shook. For a moment, he looked as broken as his battered wife.
Come down.
Gabby gestured with her weapon to the open staircase.
Come down, and we can talk about it.
He took a step toward the landing, keeping his hands glued to the banister. Gabby lowered her gun to her chest, ready to aim again should his anger return. Tears squeezed from Lewis's squinted eyes.
She was sleeping with Ben.
His voice rose another impossible decibel.
She did it, but she didn't do it for me.
Gabby again shouted for him to come down, adding noise to the cacophony. The alarm, the mechanical alerts, the anguished shouts, it all condensed in the room's double-height ceilings before pouring on top of her. Lewis turned toward Jenny. As he'd accused her, she'd managed to inch backward from the landing and grasp the top of the glass knee wall.
You're lying.
She pulled herself upright, leaning heavily against the partition.
You did it. You. I was afraid of you.
Liar.
Spittle gathered in the corners of Lewis's mouth.
Look at me,
Jenny shouted.
Look at what you've done to me. You killed her.
Lewis released the banister and stepped onto the stair landing toward his wife. Her legs vibrated.
I hate you, Sabrina, you emasculating witch. I see your broom. Do not come any closer to her.
Gabby looked down her gun slide, targeting right below Lewis's shoulder, the widest part of him as he stood with his side facing her. If she shot too low, the bullet could hit the glass, breaking the wall that kept Jenny from falling 20 feet onto the concrete floor below.
I see you flying like my mother.
Lewis took a stumbling step toward his accuser.
Above us all, you have her powers. Stay back, or I'll shoot.
Gabby changed her position as she shouted, assuming a better spot to put a bullet into Lewis before he could lay another hand on his wife, before he could murder another woman.
I always knew what you were,
Lewis pointed a shaking finger at Jenny.
You won't hurt me. You'll fly to hell.
Lewis lunged at his wife. Gabby pulled the trigger. For a moment, the shot's explosion hushed everyone and everything in the room. It seemed to compress the sound waves, enabling Gabby to hear the bullets whiz through the air toward where Lewis had stood moments before. Jenny broke the relative silence with a scream so loud it hushed the alarm. The wail had one word. Lewis. He fell forward as the shot still rang out. Jenny extended her arms as if to save him from going over the balcony. Instead of grasping his shirt, however, Jenny's palms landed flat on his stomach. Lewis stumbled backward. Gabby watched, helpless, as his heel slipped over the lip of the top step. Suddenly, he was falling off the stair, limbs flailing, desperately swimming in the air. Gabby looked away before he hit the ground. Still, she heard the crack of his head against the concrete, a hammer splitting a melon. It resounded louder than the blaring alarm,
Jenny's sobs, the glass break announcements, and Gabby's own panting breaths. She heard it on replay as she approached Lewis's body. She let her eyes travel from his twisted limbs up his torso. Gabby didn't see a bullet wound, but blood and brain matter was seeping from Lewis's broken skull. The man was dead, and she'd helped kill him. Part 4, Chapter 28, The Week After. When it came time for her own funeral, Susan wanted a closed casket. She made the decision as she examined Rachel's waxen face in the open coffin, her pale skin unnaturally tanned with layers of beige makeup, her thin lips sewn into a disapproving line. Rachel didn't look at peace. She looked pissed. Susan placed a hand over Rachel's cold fingers and mumbled a Hail Mary. The prayer was one of the few she remembered from her Catholic upbringing and seemed fitting coming from one mother to another. "I'm sorry," she whispered, swapping an apology for the amen. "I was so upset about what I thought you'd done, I didn't realize you were in danger." Susan took a breath, rose from the kneeler and retreated to a small section of unadorned wall. Lilies and white roses overwhelmed the room, springing from baskets and snaking around mounted wreaths the size of small Christmas trees. Their heavy perfume clouded the air like spring pollen. There were more bouquets than people, Susan thought. Not that the crowd was small. A mix of Rachel's relatives, co-workers, and real friends filled the room. Many parents in town had shown as well, though not as many as Susan had expected for an involved PTA mom with two kids in the local schools. Summer vacations had likely kept many away. Few could afford to cancel a trip because of the death of an acquaintance. Nadal sat across the room beside both Jonah and Jamal, whom they'd pulled from camp to support Rachel's son, Will. Jonah looked intently at his hands, hidden by the rows of chairs, likely worrying the silent balls and buttons of the fidget cube in his lap. Jamal stared at the front of the room, studying the adults in line to pay their respects. Both of her boys wore charcoal suits, as they likely would have at a trial. The tears Susan couldn't shed for the wax figure in the coffin flooded her eyes. A false accusation had come so close to tearing apart her family. Even if Nadal had ultimately prevailed in court, the seriousness of the charges would have kept him in jail until the jury verdict, depriving her sons of a father and her of a husband. And the allegations alone would have inflicted irreparable damage to Nadal's reputation, undoubtedly forcing his removal as CEO of the company he'd founded and ruining its chances of ever going public, possibly even rendering him permanently unemployable. Moreover, a not guilty verdict had never been guaranteed, despite Susan's posturing to the contrary in front of the detectives. Court cases, she knew, were about making juries want to believe in a defendant's innocence as much as they were about facts. Her husband was a wealthy man of visible Middle Eastern descent, with Muslim parents who worked for an industry reviled for taking jobs from average Americans, and he was being sued by the parents of a deceased 9-year-old boy. He was a good man, but the wrong 12 people might not have been able to see that. For a moment at the beach house, Susan herself hadn't. She swiped at the drop streaking her cheek and then scanned the crowd for the families that had not been as fortunate as her own. Ben stood at the open entrance to the private room, the somber head of a heart-wrenching receiving line that included his son and a younger woman Susan assumed was Rachel's sister. His daughter, Chloe, sat with Rachel's parents across from the coffin, their pale figures like wilting jasmine in a stark black vase. Susan wanted to say something to them, to beg forgiveness for all the ways she'd failed their mother. She'd been in the backyard with Lewis and had watched him go upstairs,
Had she not gotten so drunk? She wasn't drinking nowadays. Perhaps she would have heard him leaving the house and asked what he'd been up to. Being seen might have made Lewis rethink his plans. But she couldn't explain all that. The respectful thing, Susan decided, was to abstain from the receiving line and not remind Chloe of her mother's final day. Her family would sign the book on their way out, which would be soon. Jonah couldn't take this many strangers for much longer. Susan weaved through the crowd and then shimmied past seated guests to the open chair beside her husband. Nadal patted her side as she sat, acknowledging her return. She leaned into him, her chest tight with emotion, and mouthed a thank you to God for sparing her family the grief that had befallen the others. They'd dodged enough bullets to suggest divine intervention. Susan followed up her silent thank you with a whispered plea to help Rachel's children. She couldn't say why God had intervened for Will and Chloe. They were truly the innocent ones in all of this. A commotion by the door interrupted Susan's prayers. Ben and Will stood side by side in front of the entrance, barricading the viewing area rather than welcoming people inside. The already quiet room hushed. Susan rose to better see over the turned heads of Rachel's family members. Jenny stood in the arched entrance to the room, hunched like a much older woman. A silver cuff shone on each arm, connected to the crutches that supported Jenny's hands and, judging from her stance, the majority of her weight. She wore a knee-length black dress. A plaster cast protruded below it, covering the length of her right calf. Susan had heard of Jenny's injuries through the police. She'd been waiting at the station for Detective Watkins's return when the desk officer had suddenly begun dispatching units to the beach house's address, shouting about a man beating his wife half to death. Hearing of Lewis's brutality, however, had not prepared Susan for the evidence. Jenny's bottom lip was scabbed and swollen. A jam-colored stain spread beside her mouth. Yellow and green bruises encircled her neck. Her black eye had finally healed, though, allowing an undistracted look into her sad doe eyes. Allie wanted to pay her respects, Jenny said. Susan had missed the presence of Jenny's daughter. She squinted at the entrance, noticing the young woman partially shielded by Jenny's frail figure. The girl had ash-blonde curls and an incongruous tan. It was Allie, Susan realized with a start. Jenny's daughter had bleached the auburn hair she'd inherited from her father. Ben looked over his shoulder at his own daughter, her face hidden in her grandmother's chest, and then back at Jenny. His expression befitted a man lashed to the rack. Chloe knows. He dropped his head. Maybe just Allie. Susan couldn't make sense of Ben's words, though Jenny's lack of movement while Allie went inside made their meaning clear enough. Jenny wasn't allowed in. Ben couldn't welcome the spouse of his wife's murderer. Allie approached the coffin, head down to avoid the crowd gawking as though she'd been a co-conspirator in her father's crime. Her frail shoulders shook with sobs. The line waiting to have a look at the mortician's work retreated, allowing her to cut in front. Allie dropped to the kneeler with a choked groan. Jenny looked on, her bruised mouth wrenched in pain, unable to soothe her daughter without causing Ben's suffering family more grief. Allie bawled, as though her own parent lay in the casket. A murmur rippled through the seats. Female voices mumbled about appropriateness and decorum. Imagine how hard it is for Chloe, seeing her. It was her father. Susan shuffled from her row and then walked around the viewing line. Gingerly, she placed a hand on Allie's shoulder. She wanted to tell her she wasn't responsible for her father's actions and that she didn't need to feel ashamed. But she also didn't want to presume to know how Allie was feeling. Sometimes silent support was the best kind.
I'm so sorry, Mrs. Hansen. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Allie's apologies dribbled out between sobs. Susan helped her stand, wrapping an arm around her side. She guided her back to where her mother had stood moments before, beside a frightened-looking Ben. Jenny had already left the room. Susan spied her hobbled form over Ben's shoulder, heading toward the exit. She released Allie to follow. Before the girl could hurry toward her mom, Ben stopped her with a pat on the arm. "Hey, Allie." A smile materialized on his strained face. "No one blames you, kiddo. I hope you know that. What happened is not your fault." Allie lifted her head for the first time since arriving, looking directly into Ben's dark blue eyes.
"I know, Mr. Hansen. I know it's not my fault."
She pointed in Jenny's direction.
"But what happened to my mom is yours."
Chapter 29, The Week After. Gabby leaned against a column supporting the covered entrance to Dinah Collette's home, the lab report rolled in her right hand like a riot stick. Mariel's urine had tested positive for the prescription sedative Zolpidem. The technician with whom Gabby had spoken that morning had insisted that the levels he'd detected were typical of drug abusers, or those who had developed such a tolerance to the medication that they required multiple pills to sleep. Mariel hadn't struck Gabby as either an addict or an insomniac. Dinah emerged from the front door, her long legs extending from the white skirt of a tennis dress. The day was ripe for the sport. Bright, sunny, with little humidity and a firm breeze off the water. For once, Gabby wasn't sweating in her suit jacket as she waited outside. Annoyance, however, had prickled the hairs on her neck. She hadn't asked the housekeeper for Dinah, she'd asked for Marielle. "Detective Watkins, good to see you again." Dinah extended her hand for a shake, forcing Gabby to shift the paper baton to her non-dominant side.